Audrey Guzman versus St. Francis Hospital, and arguing for St. Francis Hospital is Mike Apfeld. You will have 15 minutes, according to my notes. John Skilton of Madison will have 10 minutes as representing the Physicians Insurance Company, and there will be 3 minutes rebuttal by you, Mr. Apfeld.
Yes.
2 minutes by Mr. Skilton.
Yes, although in the reverse order. Mr. Skilton will stand up first.
I'll do that. Yes. So it'll be 2 minutes for he, Pam, and two minutes for you. Counsel?
May it please the court. My name is Michael Apfeld, and, Your Honor, I actually represent the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. Mr. Nelson, who represents St. Francis Hospital, and his carrier has ceded his time to me. Again, I represent the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. The fund, as you will undoubtedly remember, was created by statute in 1975. That same statute required all health care practitioners in Wisconsin to carry certain minimum limits of insurance, which have varied from time to time. The fund is the statutory excess carrier, which insures medical malpractice claims for all amounts above those statutory limits. In essence, the fund guarantees that Mrs. Guzman and all other medical malpractice plaintiffs will actually collect the judgments that they win. This is a benefit enjoyed by no other class of tort plaintiffs in Wisconsin. Now, the particular provision of the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Law now at issue is the provision enacted in 1995 which caps the recovery of non-economic damages at $350,000 per occurrence. It places no limit on the recovery of any other type of damage, the payment of which, as I noted before, is guaranteed by the fund. This cap represents a legislative balancing of competing policies and interests. In this respect, it is no different than scores of other statutes which have, from time to time, modified and limited available remedies, immunized entire classes of tortious actors from their own negligence, abolished entire causes of action, or occupied entire fields formerly occupied by the common law. All of these statutes are routinely accepted as legitimate exercises of the legislative will and policymaking function. Now, if we keep this in perspective, I submit to the court that the only real question facing this court on this appeal is whether the statutory cap bears a minimally rational relationship to the legislative goals. And I would submit to you that manifestly it does. First and foremost, the cap protects the system that guarantees that victims of malpractice will have their judgments paid. Now, concern over the solvency of the fund has been essentially perennial. It's existed since the beginning of the fund. As a matter of fact, in 1975, when the fund was created, the statute provided that if the cap fell below a certain stated amount for 2 years in a row, that all damages would be limited to $500,000. As best I understand, that cap was never called into play. But by 1985, the legislature was sufficiently concerned with continuing fund deficits that it decided to experiment with a temporary, that is, five-year cap, a $1 million cap on non-economic damages. The constitutionality of that cap was never directly tested. But by 1995, the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance, in connection with the cap now at issue, advised the legislature that if a $250,000 cap, that is a cap slightly lower than the one at issue, were in place over a five-year period, there would be a savings experience, that is a loss experience, of somewhat in excess of $67 million less. So this cap is simply the latest expression of a long line of legislative concern over the solvency of the fund. Now, stop for a minute and think. How many victims of automobile accidents, injured just as grievously as Mrs. Guzman, and she was grievously injured, have little or no practical recourse whatsoever for their injuries because the driver, the negligent driver, was simply uninsured? How many victims of medical malpractice in other states have, at best, limited recourse because those states have no funds guaranteeing recovery, and the negligent physician in those states has only a minimum amount of insurance.
Mr. Apfel, let me interrupt you for a minute. Since you're talking about other states, the briefs on both sides here would seem to indicate that the majority of states has taken a particular position in regard to caps. And I'm curious as to which side is correct.
Well, you know what they say about statistics, Your Honor. The answer cannot be... the answer is a little more complicated. We are ultimately correct. But,
why does that answer not surprise me?
But you must understand that the decisions that we are talking about fall into several categories. Some of them deal with non-economic caps on non-economic damages in medical malpractice actions. Some deal with caps on all damages in medical malpractice actions. Some deal with caps on non-economic damages in all personal injury actions, or occasionally in certain very narrow classes of personal injury actions, and others deal with general limits. So it's very difficult to generalize. If Your Honor is interested in statistics, I can tell you that there have been, by my count, 5 cases which have upheld caps on non-economic damages in medical malpractice cases, 2 cases which have struck down caps on non-economic damages in medical malpractice cases, 5 jurisdictions which have upheld caps on all damages in medical malpractice cases, 5 cases which have struck down such limits, that is, across-the-board limits on all sorts of damages in medical malpractice cases, and kind of a mishmash of all those other things from which you can draw various lessons.
Is there any particular case from another jurisdiction that you think is especially persuasive on the idea of caps in regard to non-economic loss?
Well,
because obviously statistics aren't what's important to us. What's important to us is whether or not there is persuasive authority from another jurisdiction.
Yes, the answer is yes, and in just a moment I will identify those cases that I think are perhaps the most persuasive. But I will make note here of one fact, Your Honor. That is, of all the cases out there, and particularly all the cases cited by the plaintiff, there is, I believe, not a single case which has struck down a limit on non-economic damages alone where there was a fund or fund-like guarantee of recovery from the first dollar to infinity. I believe there are none. Now, the cases that I think are most persuasive and that should be looked at the most would be Fine versus Permanente from California. I would also recommend Jones versus St. Vincent from Indiana. I think that Etheridge versus Medical Center from Virginia and Boyd versus Buelela, also from the Third Circuit, are also persuasive. And that is not to say that there is not persuasive reasoning in some of the other cases that we cited, and in fact there are other cases, if you will. But I understand and I apologize that if there is a little bit of confusion, because each of these cases takes a slightly different approach, each has a slightly different interpretation. Your Honor, if I could make just one more and follow it up. There are 2 cases upon which the plaintiff relied in particular in its brief, and that is Best versus Taylor Machine and Sophie versus Fiberboard. I would note that both of those cases involve caps on personal injury actions in general and clearly without any sort of guarantee. I'm sorry, Your Honor. You had a...
Counsel, I had a question based on caps, and the argument is made by opposing counsel that, look, if the cap is $10,
but
the cap is $1, then doesn't that literally take away the right to have a jury make a decision? Now, you indicated, and I know in workman's comp and other areas, that the legislature has made a point of limiting recovery. But what about that argument? That what if the legislature said no recovery or $10? The fact that it's $350,000 doesn't, quote, shock the conscience of perhaps some of the members of the court, but if it were $10, I'm sure that there'd be some concern about that.
Well, are you speaking now of non-economic damages?
Yes.
Okay. I would say that any cap on economic or non-economic damages is subject to the minimal rational scrutiny test. And the lower you go, the perhaps the more scrutiny a cap would be subject to. But Your Honor's question was compound. First, because of the benefits of the system, I do not believe that a cap on non-economic damages at $350,000, at $100,000, or at zero would shock the conscience. It does not shock my conscience, and I should suggest it should not shock the conscience of the court in light of the benefits of the system that it preserves.
What's the benefits that are preserved? So in other words, it would be all right for the legislature to say zero for non-economic damages.
Well, of course, that is not the limit at issue, Your Honor.
No, but that's what you said.
I believe that
said it could be capped at any point because of the other benefits. Or did I mishear you?
Well, I perhaps did not elaborate on that. Your Honor, I believe that the lower you get, perhaps the greater justification is necessary. I believe that for the stated reasons that this legislature, and which is manifest in this legislation, that yes, you could cap it at that low. And there are reasons. I think that economic damages are highly distinguishable from non-economic damages.
Non-economic damages is the pain and suffering, right?
Pain and suffering, emotional distress, loss of society and companionship, humiliation, and there are a few others that are specified in the statute, and economic damages is everything else. And there is a distinction between those two. I mean, no matter what you think of non-economic damages in general, everyone concedes that they are not subject to any particular standard of measurement. And if I may get back to the second part of Justice Wilcox's question, the question also contained, implied that this was an incursion on the jury's, the right of a jury trial. And while my co-counsel, Mr. Skilton, will address this in greater detail, it is our position that that this cap, and no cap, infringes on the right of a jury trial, because the cap simply specifies the law.
Well, counsel, this gets to the question that the chief, I think, gets to a question that the chief was asking. If you would have a limit of $10 on non-economic damages recoverable for acts of omission of a health care provider, isn't that tantamount to having no remedy whatsoever?
That is tantamount to elimination, say for $10, of one element of damages for a cause of action for medical malpractice. We must keep in mind that every dollar of economic damage is recoverable here. I don't know about you, but I would far prefer to have a collectible judgment for $5 million than a worthless piece of paper for $10. And
but
that is what the system...
But it would be better to have good damages for $15, $10, and $5.
It would, but we can't always get everything we want in this world, and the legislature has balanced benefits and burdens.
And what are the... As I heard you, you said the cap was okay at zero because of the great benefits that are given.
It could be.
Okay. What are the benefits?
The benefits are, first, to preservation of the solvency of the fund, and I think that I've gone over that. And second, the cap tends to decrease the cost and increase the availability of health care for all Wisconsin citizens.
What evidence in the record is there that without this cap, the fund will be depleted?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that there is any particular evidence in the record, but of course this court is obliged to assume that facts exist. And in fact, the fund has run a deficit almost since its inception.
Why are we obliged to assume that facts exist? In the Richards-Martin case, one of the things the majority relied on was, first, there's little evidence of that few individuals received non-economic damages, and they went into some discussion regarding that. So why should we infer that facts exist?
Well, that is the standard of review by which this court tests the constitutionality of statutes which are entitled to the heaviest presumption, of constitutionality. Now, as I pointed out, it is in the record that this would save, this would reduce the amount of assessments the fund needed to make by 67 some odd million dollars over a period of 5 years. No one has denied that that the fund is perpetually in the state of working against deficits, and for that matter, I am not convinced that it absolutely needs to be working against the deficit so long as there is a distinct economic benefit to the fund. And it's undeniable that there is such an economic benefit to the fund. There's also, as I was going to say, an economic benefit to the citizens of Wisconsin as a whole. We cannot kid ourselves. The notion that malpractice judgments are simply absorbed by the negligent physicians or their insurers is simply a naive assumption. While you can quibble about the quantity, the fact of the matter is that the majority of those damages are passed on to the citizens of Wisconsin in the form of higher costs for health care. Now, I see that my time is up, and I would like to finish the sentence and pass on to Mr. Skilton. But anyway, these are definite benefits, benefits that are undeniable on the basic economic facts of life and which clearly are logically related to the statute, the provisions of the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Apfeld. Ms. Skilton?
May it please the court, John Skilton, Foley and Lardner. I'm representing Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, Dr. James Sullivan, Dr. Richard Fitzpatrick, and the Southeastern Emergency Medical Services Clinic. Your Honors, I will award my rebuttal time to Mr. Apfeld as he is carrying the burden of the equal protection due process arguments, and instead I would, with the court's indulgence, like to come at the case somewhat differently based on the multitude of briefs that the court has received. This case is an important case to the state of Wisconsin and to this court. Indeed, it comes back to first principles here. We're not involved here in statutory construction. We're involved in constitutional construction. And this court has struggled. One recent decision, for example, labeled the state of the law with respect to Article 1, Section 9 as being in disarray. And I am well aware of at least one opinion which exposes a certain disagreement as amongst the panel.
But subtle. You're being very polite.
But I want to return to... I want to return to first principles, and the first principle I want to return to is the principle that was delegated in 1848 by those who came to that constitutional convention in the form of Article 14, Section 13, which talks about what happens to the common law. And the phrase that I want the court to use and construe and place a part of this decision as it balances other rights, which my esteemed colleague Mr. Warshawski is going to get into and I will touch upon, is the phrase, 1848, until altered or suspended by the legislature. That was an express delegation to the legislature of its right to amend the common law. Prospectively, I would acknowledge a lot of the court's struggle has dealt in Martin, for example, with retroactive implications, indeed with the distinction between statutes of repose and statutes of limitations. Again, there's an element of retroactivity, but this is a prospective delegation of the absolute right to suspend or modify, and within that right, by the way, is the right to limit. Asking about cases that address that issue, I refer to Fine. The Missouri case is a very good case that's cited in the briefs. The Virginia cases. It's a self-evident proposition that that express delegation delegates the right to limit. And so we get to the question of whether fundamental rights are then implicated by this delegation of express powers. And really, if you ask me, the argument is trying directly and indirectly to get the court to a higher standard of scrutiny of these acts under strict scrutiny or something other than the 14th Amendment standard that the court is more than well aware of. And it's done by the effort to use Article 1, Section 5, the right to jury, inviolate, and Article 1, Section 9, the right to a certain remedy. So the court is being asked here now to construe three delegated 1848 original constitutional provisions. That's what it's really doing today. It is an important case, and it will govern how lawyers argue remedies and rights in tort cases and every other case from now on out. This court needs to come to grasp with that, and I'm going to suggest how I come to grasp with it.
What was the first constitutional citation you gave us?
I said Article 14, Section 13, Justice Babbage. I think I'm right on that. And that's the common law issue.
One of the last sections.
Yes, and it's in the section that deals with the legislative powers.
Additional
Article 14, Section 1, I think, deals with the legislature's right to make laws in this
state. The transitional kind of section.
Got it.
Until things get going, right?
Yes, and I think it's one that this court focuses on. I'll talk about the community and commonality of working the common law. This court has had really a great experience in its own right of fooling around with immunities, as Holyetz and Stanhope and other cases that people on this panel are more than slightly familiar with. But I want to talk about the jury issue first. The right to a jury inviolate. That has been construed by a number of courts, and I think implicitly by this court, is meaning the right to get a finding of fact by a jury. And why do I make that distinction? When we have been concerned about substantive aspects of the right to a jury, in criminal law, we're talking about the right to a fair and impartial tribunal, 12 men and women, fair and true, issues relating to corruption of the system. That's what we're talking about. Are we talking about a verdict inviolate?
Well, counsel.
A jury verdict? Yes,
Your Honor. Maybe we are. For example, if the jury comes back and says damages are $500,000, great, and there's no cap in the legislature, and the judge thinks that is too high, the judge says to the parties,
remitter,
cut it, remitter,
give an alternative
to 350, but if you don't like that, you have to have a new trial. And the reason that the court has done that is it views that you don't get it, you haven't had a full jury trial. How do you distinguish
that's
that?
A fax as submitted, but that's not the legislative policy that's implicated by a limitation of remedies that occurs as a matter of law, which the legislature deals with as a matter of remedies. The issues are not the same, and there is no preemption. Just because the court has the right here to pass on sufficiency questions does not preempt the legislature's right to control remedy at the end of the way as a matter of public policy of the state of Wisconsin. And that's what the Constitution is telling us. This is a different area. It's something that is not preempted.
I suggest that constitutional provision doesn't mean what it says, because the common law is changed periodically by this court.
This court has made it clear that it is the ultimate institution that passes on constitutionality. And it does so, though, by not exclusive control of the area of controlling the common law and working it. It does it in consistent coordination with the legislature. Sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. And when it gets to whether the legislature is dealing it takes the presumption of constitutionality, the old Hurstian propositions that we've heard for 35 years, and all presumptions to the legislature, and we don't talk about $10 because, you know, it was $350,000 that the legislature was talking about. We don't look for facts that find it unconstitutional. We look for facts that find it constitutional.
But counsel, the $10, or I can choose $10,000 or $100,000, I offer that by way of example as an extreme to test the theory, and that's the way we test the theories. And it seems to me pretty valid. Of a test. I don't know where you end up with at the test, but what you're suggesting to, I think, to this court, that the legislature has almost unfettered ability to make a remedy. Leave it to the court, legislature to make a remedy. And my hypothetical is, well, if they make a remedy with $10, don't we have problems?
The legislature must have a rational basis. This court must find it. And if 10 is not rational, and not supportable under the presumption of constitutionality, constitutional law, then it is unconstitutional.
Well, perhaps a $10, depending on what you mean by rational basis, of course, perhaps a $10 figure would be balanced against, as your co-counsel says, the economic benefit to the fund, the economic benefit to every citizen of this state. You know, so, okay, so a couple that are injured have to suffer. Big deal.
I'm sorry, my time is limited. The issue of non-economic versus economic is one that courts have dealt with. Justice Traynor, I believe, was cited in the Fine decision. The ABA took a position on economic damages, refused to take a position on non-economic damages. There are distinctions here that are in the nature of these unquantifiable, horrible injuries that are in the nature of the sub one of the section defined by the legislature in those terms. And the legislature can make a rational distinction between certain elements of damages as it deals with remedies prospectively in the common law and is tested under the rational basis test.
Well, give us the test. Let me see what
Can this court conceive of a rational basis for the legislature based on its own analysis of the likely input, including actual input? By the way, the court asked about whether there was anything in the record. I happen to have been representing the fund in the Reddy case, a $9 million non-economic. It's in the, by the way, it's in the brief of I think it's Waddle brief, where it cites the facts relating to it. One case, $9 million. On a non-economic recovery, that's a significant sum, and it overrides a lot of the smaller cases, and there is an element of protection of the fund. And the Missouri case dealt with a $14 million non-economic return, which was excruciating in its facts in terms of the injuries to that little girl who was burned and had was brain injured by the
counsel. Okay. So the rational basis to protect the fund. What is so great about the fund? You can also protect the fund by raising premiums, and that spreads it among many instead of asking this one person to bear the burden,
you know,
or a handful.
Judge, you could do it, or some other institution could do it, economic considerations and balances. Is $350 enough, or could it be $1 million, or should it be $10 million? And that particular institution, this court has consistently said on issues of legislative and economic policy, is the legislature. So my answer to you is, you could, but you're not involved in substantive due process since Nebbia, and the, you know, the United States.
The new coming thing,
well,
John.
I'm arguing against it, Your Honor.
The U.S. Supreme Court is going in that direction.
Well, you know, this
very
court
well
this court has been very jealous of its own constitution in a number of decisions that relate to, for example, First Amendment rights that I'm somewhat familiar with. And I think in this instance it can understand a bad idea. You know, Franklin Roosevelt understood a bad idea at some point in his career. He didn't pack the court, but the court got the message. My dad used to say it smelled the drapes burning.
All right. So your rational basis argument is that the legislature can do it.
My argument is essentially Mr. Abfeld's argument on the issue of rational basis. I am trying to tell the court that we haven't reached the level of protected rights and suspect classes in the way we've dealt with the other constitutional provisions that Mr. Warshawski is relying on.
And so rational basis, very light touch, almost nothing.
Your Honor, if that's what the court's been doing for the last 40 years, then that's what the court's been doing.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Ted M. Warshawski, representing the plaintiff respondents, Audrey Guzman. Mr. Warshawski.
Chief Justice, members of the court.
Didn't we have a very humorous thing happen the last time you appeared in front of
us? I thought you might.
I
thought you established that because you suggested that address, we might recognize that although I'm not bright, I'm educable.
I remind you every time I see you. Mr. Warshawski addressed me as sir.
And then
to rectify it.
I never remember that part of the story. Go ahead.
I hope that this isn't part of my time.
Part of the court's time. Go ahead, Mr. Warshawski.
My colleague, Mr. Skilton, and I agree that this appeal involves fundamental and important issues that have real implications for the future of jurisprudence in this state. Now, without abandoning or repeating the arguments made in appellant's brief, I'm going to limit my remarks to less than 10 minutes and cover only 3 points that I think are salient and of constitutional importance. One, the right to trial by jury. Two, the role of the judiciary as an equal and independent part of our governmental triad, which I think is a very, very important point that was not touched on by counsel. The denial of equal protection implicit in the irrational creation of multiple subclasses within a subclass that the court has previously recognized in Strakowski for procedural purposes only, although I recognize that there have been opinions that suggest that this applies to substantive law too, the subclass. The first two, the right to trial by jury and the independence of the judiciary, are fundamental rights, and unless I've misread multiple cases, they're rights that require strict scrutiny and not a rational basis analysis. The subclasses within the subclass, whose differentiation is based only upon the severity of the injury and the marital status of the parties, strikes me as one that is a suspect subclass, multiple subclasses, that also deserve the same class of review. The appellants in briefs and arguments, I'm not going to go to cases here unless the court asks me about specific cases. In all of the briefs and arguments, the appellants failed to distinguish between common law rights that existed at passage of the Wisconsin Constitution as opposed to those legislatively created thereafter, and this is a critical distinction, and I can list cases from 1850 through to 1995 of this court, not foreign courts, that make that distinction. At common law, one could not sue the government. On the other hand, a case like Makos, where the court applied a rational basis test, was dealing with the discovery rule, which first came into existence in Wisconsin in 1983 when it was adopted in the case of Hansen v. Robbins, 113 West 2nd 550. The right to trial by jury antedates the creation of this country. And as was said in State v. Cameron in 1850, it is not granted by these instruments, it is secured, and neither legislatures nor courts have any power to infringe even the last of its privileges. Now, I recognize that stare decisis can change. I do not believe that fundamental constitutional rights can be changed other than by constitutional amendment. If otherwise, why was it necessary in this state to have a constitutional amendment to go from a 12-person jury to a 5-6 jury? And there are, again, multitudes of cases in which this court has stated and restated that fact. Most of them are covered in our brief.
Mr. Wyszewski.
Yes, ma'am.
We've got an existing cause of action on medical malpractice. Couldn't the legislature just abolish the whole cause of action? They did on, what was it, breach of promise to marry. What was the other one that is always used?
Workers' compensation.
No.
The alienation
of affections is the one. I mean, they just said no. But they said no to these cause of action. Totally abolished. That's been upheld. Someone was injured. And that meant no jury trial.
I believe that there are two answers to that. Number one, I believe, and I say that with qualification, I do not believe that these causes existed prior to the adoption of the Constitution in this state. And since I have not researched those two, I can only say that I have not found any case in which a cause that existed prior to the Constitution was subject to legislative change without some form of quid pro quo. The other thing is that there are complete abolishment of a claim is something that the legislature can do under certain circumstances, but you can't abolish half of the claim. And there we do get into a number of cases. Some of them are quoted as recently as the Makos case, the Mulder case, and I think the Gust case, involving the fact that there was a complete change, the right to sue a fellow employee was completely done away with, and there was a quid pro quo. And again, I because the court has dealt with so many of these issues recently, I am not giving the citations, but I certainly can on any one of these propositions. I hope that answers the question.
So you can outlaw it, but you can't regulate it.
Pardon?
You can outlaw it, but you can't regulate it.
I believe that's true, and you can change things by constitution, and we do that all the time. We see that in what's happened in this court with the issue of abortion. If the Supreme Court says it's a fundamental right, it's a fundamental right, and the states can't do anything about it, except that a constitutional amendment can do it. You can see that with, and that I think is very clear constitutional jurisprudence. Now, Mr. Skilton made reference of Article 14, Section 13, the right of the legislature to change. But I would only say in passing, the legislature has no right to change a fundamental constitutional right, except by constitutional means, which is an amendment to the Constitution. And I think that the legislature recognized this when one looks at the law that they passed. And the argument that Mr. Skilton made about, well, you have a jury trial even though it's meaningless. There is the remedy, the verdict. You get the verdict, but then the judge disregards it. Judge McMahon characterized that as merely going through the motions. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that the legislature attempted an end run around the constitutional problem, which they are presumed to have recognized, when they mandated that the jury not know that their verdict was meaningless. So the lawyers presumably get in front of the jury, and the judge gives instructions, and the judge tells them that they are uniquely qualified, and that is the standard jury instruction, uniquely qualified to measure pain, suffering, and loss of the pleasures of life. And I very respectfully suggest to Mr. Skilton that living a life that has no quality, without getting into questions of the right to death, living a right life that has no quality is, to me at least, much worse than living a life that has no money.
Well,
but yes, sir.
Let me just touch on that, because as I understand it, of course, we're talking about $350,000, and I know your brief talked about $10, but in the sense that it is $350,000, and this court would say, well, we'll apply a rational basis, that you still have the right to a jury trial within those confines, and a judge would still have the right, say that he came back at $250,000, under additure, the judge could say, no, I think it should be $350,000. So when you say, what you're saying is that if there's any cap, and I'll say the cap was $10 million, what would your position be then? Would it be different, or would it be, I assume, the same, that there should be no, that the legislature cannot put a cap on things that interfere with a jury's ability to make a decision?
In this area, and again, I'm trying to avoid repeating my brief, well, the right to recovery for these injuries existed prior to 1848. That's number one. Rights that existed prior to 19, there's case after case, there are cases that I'll put some of them in the record now. Perhaps I should do that. I mentioned State v. Carville. There's the Narvel case in 1853, 2 Wisconsin 17, Lebeau v. Baltazar, 180 was 419, 1923, Campbell v. Sutcliffe, 1927 case, 193-370, Jennings v. Safeguard, 13 was second, 427, 1960. The Strakowski case, which has been mentioned here and is mentioned in all of the briefs, said that the law was constitutional, 655 was constitutional, because it only delayed but did not take away. It preserved the right to trial by jury. And no one is saying here, and there's plenty of case law that says that the legislature, there's a real estate case that I could find here if I looked for it, but it says the same thing. Or a tax case that says, well, look, there's going to be delays in getting justice sometimes, and that's not unconstitutional. And that's what the court said in Strakowski, but the language of Strakowski is that it did not impair the right to trial by jury. And I could go on. Parkman Hosiery Company is 1979, and I've got a half a dozen others here, and they all say the same thing. Now, I'd then like to turn to, I would make this remark. What they're doing is demeaning to the judiciary. I don't know if it's presumptuous of me to suggest to this court that we put a trial judge up there, and the trial judge reads instructions that tell them how to deliberate, and the instructions have no meaning. I mean, I don't understand that. I'd then like to turn to the independence of the judiciary, and this could be a very short argument because this court knows more about that than I ever will. This court is a third and independent arm of government. I think that somebody should suggest that to the legislature. Somebody should suggest that to the county boards. My county board, which took away the right of judges to provide coffee to juries during deliberations, the county boards that will not pay for deputies in divorce courts where there have been shootings, and the legislature, which will not give enough judges in areas where they're needed. There has been an effort afoot in this country for ages to make the judiciary essentially an administrative arm, an arm of administration and legislation. This court had the right in common law for remittiture, and later was given the right for additor. And in the case, and the case that I'm thinking of is not the Powers case, it was a case before that, where remittiture was became the law, this court said that this was the historic rights of judges. I think that I'd like to just jump down to the Thoe decision, which is quoted in our brief. And Thoe is most destructive because the decision was rendered less than 20 years after the adoption of the Constitution, I believe 19 years. And it involved an effort by the legislature to determine in advance whether evidence is legally sufficient in every case under certain circumstances. Now, what that did, what the court said was that the legislature can't do that. What they said in Lebeau v. Baltazar, which is 180 was 423, that you can't circumvent the Constitution for, quotes, a better public policy. But all that's argued here is a better public policy. You were asked to take essentially judicial notice of the fact of what's going on with the patient's compensation fund. And since I can't go beyond the issues in this trial, I can't express my opinions as to what goes on with the patient's compensation fund. I think that that's all I'm going to say, because we've made all of our arguments about the independence of the judiciary, and I do say this, and this transcends my feelings in this case. Obviously, I want to win. I represent this injured lady, and I have an economic interest in winning. But as long as I practice law, I have been horrified by the way, within my lifetime, that the judiciary has lost its powers. Whether as a judge down in, it was either Kenosha or Racine, that ordered the county board to give them an air conditioner so it could work during the summer, or whether it's the legislature saying they're not going to go through the troubles of a constitutional amendment to comply with the Constitution. Sure, they can change the law, but they have to do it constitutionally. The last thing that I'd like to do, area I'd like to remark on, are the multiple subclasses. Strakowski stood for, we've discussed Strakowski. What they have done is created three classes. Those who are least injured who get 100% of justice. Those who are married and have to split the pie or cake with their spouse, and those who are really disadvantaged who are married and have children. This is really a family-oriented law. The more kids you have, the less money you get for your injuries. And they make it clear that it's per occurrence. As pointed out in Makos, This court is generally ill-equipped as an institution to do fact-finding. This is my last point. Regarding the legitimacy of the premises underlying a particular piece of legislation, and this relates to the questions that were asked by some of you as to what benefit there is from this, and the statements about this will help us actuarially. However, the history of the legislation, as we set forth in our brief, gives no rational basis for this, even though strict scrutiny should be the hallmark. There's no rational basis. And I refer the court to the statement that there can be no denial that the fund is in bad shape. An appellate's brief on page 162, we quote some statistics, and we put a lot of statistics into that. Pardon me, that's the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers brief, and they did cover a different subject from ours. It wasn't just a repetition. They put in statistics, not something somebody said in Missouri, or on my part, something somebody said in Oregon. And what are the statistics? From 1991 to 97, they went from $73 million to $63 million in payouts, and that's on page 162 of the appendix. Just roughly, and this is a rough calculation, in 1997 dollars, I would assume that the 63 million in 1991 dollars in 1997 was about $43 million. They'd gone down to a little bit above half in payouts, when you consider payouts. In Martins v. Richards, the question was asked about what is there's a paucity of evidence. The court, in looking at that case at that time. So I went back to the 1994 data, and would you hand that to me, please? The 1994 data, because this legislation was passed in early 1995, late 1994, early 1995. It took effect, I believe, in May of 1995. Now, I went to the appendix. And in the appendix on page 162, in 1994, the loss ratio was 20%. And based upon that, they eviscerated what rights were still left to injured persons. I would like to end these remarks.
And now, what's your point? That there wasn't a reason to put a cap on because the fund wasn't in danger?
Yes, I think this, Your Honor. I do agree with the cases to say that, in other than strict scrutiny, but when one is talking rational basis, that it's the obligation of this court to try to uphold laws if there is a rational basis for them. But for the rational basis to be that somebody gets up and says there's a shortage or there's a danger or doctors are leaving the state or God knows what's happening, doesn't show this court there's any rational basis for taking away, and this is the first time I'll use that this phrase, for taking away rights and being grossly unfair to quadriplegic people like my client. All the money she's going to get out of these, the economic damages, her economic damages will go right back to the doctors who put her in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. These are the only damages she'll get. Her economic damages will go to Medicare, Medicaid.
Well, she's going to get payments for all her medical care for the rest of her life.
That's right. She'll lie as a quadriplegic in a bed or in a wheelchair, and the people who injured her will, for some public policy reason, pay to take care of her and keep her alive in that state. That's true, Your Honor. That's what happens with this law.
What would she get if you prevailed?
If I prevailed, she'd get enough money to buy a nice house. She'd get enough money to have a nice way of getting to see her kids and her grandkids. She'd have enough money to do whatever enhances her quality of life. And That's what would happen if we prevail.
The economic damages wouldn't cover a facility that she could live in and air conditioning?
To some degree, yes. They would. There's another aspect to this, and this is not something, if I'm going beyond the brief, these cases, these laws make cases impossible for attorneys to handle. Because if we lose in this case, and if I handle the case, and if I get her what appears to be a reasonable pile of money for her medical care that will take care of an air-conditioned house and a way of getting to a sink in an electrified wheelchair like this and so forth, and if I take a fee on that, she can have that money. We have cases in our office, and I think the court, because every member of the court is, of course, a lawyer, can take notice of this. We have the cost of processing these cases. We have cases in our office that we will not handle. We have cases in our office where people have said to us, and I think legitimately, what's the reason to bring this case? What's the reason to bring the case? Every penny that I'm getting is under an ERISA policy for my care, is under an ERISA policy where they have 100% subrogation. They do pay the lawyers. The lawyers get paid. And if I get $350,000, that's what this is all involved in. And the lawyers have, I think, an ethical question. The ethical question is, how can you advise a client to go ahead with a case like this? The law shouldn't be for the lawyers, and the law shouldn't be for some special bits for the doctors.
Let me see if I understand that. That to just bring the case for $350,000 and economic damages isn't really economically feasible to hire a lawyer.
No lawyer who can handle a case like this. I mean, look at the quality of opposition I have. This case, we have depositions all over the place. There are four defendants, and every defendant has their own neurosurgeon to testify. There are five defendants, one doesn't. And there are four neurosurgeons, and there are people here and people there. We go around in circles. A case like this to get to trial has got to cost, if it goes through trial, $75,000, $80,000 anyway, not counting lawyers' time and anything else. Now, this is the same problem that the legislature dealt with in an area where they had the authority, because wrongful death did not exist at common law. So I do agree that the legislature can do almost anything with wrongful death if they don't violate equal protection and due process. I think it was Lord Campbell's Act was the first wrongful death case a little bit before I was born. But what was happening with wrongful death was there's no way that anybody, no way that any good, experienced lawyer, and you have to be, in most instances, experienced to handle a medical malpractice case.
Okay, but counsel, then with your client, if they can't sue and get a lawyer to sue, your client going to recover economic damages without a lawyer and a lawsuit?
Well, that's the conundrum, Your Honor. There is an incentive for the lawyer. In this case, if we lose this case and we go to trial, and I get a verdict for X dollars from my client for economic damages, there is an incentive for me in a case where there's major economic damages because I get paid a portion of it. But that portion of it ends up putting the client in a position where they're not getting anything more than they would have gotten from their insurance or from the government, from Medicare and Medicaid. They don't have the nice house with the nice ramp and so forth and so on. They operate marginally from an economic standpoint. And that strikes me as...
You're saying that really is a double whammy against the person who's been
injured. I can represent...
One, they keep the damages down, non-economic damages, and because of that, they in effect will reduce all damages.
Yes, and
I carried the dice.
Yes, and what's happened as a reality is that the offices in the state that do medical malpractice work are turning away cases in large numbers, and that doesn't keep our offices from being economically viable. An office like mine always finds a way to make a buck, but it certainly is not good for the citizen. But the other thing is, Judge, I strongly recommend, Chief, I strongly recommend the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers appendix. It's full of data. It's not just one statement. And I think going back to Makos and parts of Makos, that I agree that the court has to strain to find a rational basis. But this legislation went through in very short order, and the history is in the appendix, and there is nothing to justify that they're having any of these financial problems. Everything, quite to the contrary, rates were falling and falling substantially for doctors before the passage of this law. And if one recognizes, as in Makos, I know Justice Bradley commented on tails, and by that I mean tails in insurance policy. And if one recognizes that, and again looks at these figures, you'll find that in all of these years, in 1995, the year of passage, when this case could not have had any effect, there was a rise in the loss ratio and a rise in payouts.
What page are you referring to?
I'm referring to page 162 of the appendix of the Wisconsin Academy.
Okay.
And you're going to have years, I don't disagree with Mr. Skilton in this regard, you are going to have years where there's going to be a big payout and years where there's going to be a little payout. The fact that most cases are most overwhelmingly lost by plaintiffs in this era of tort reform, you know, but occasionally we get lucky and we win a case. And so there could jump up and down, but if you look at this, in 95, when there was a peak up, this law had not had any effect. And in 96, when this law would have had virtually no effect, there was a 13% loss ratio. That means that out of every dollar, 87 cents was profit. Now, bald statements about the deficit, and, you know, I think somebody maybe ought to look at the, you know, that includes the administrative costs. Thank you very much.
Did the trial court made no findings of fact with respect to the status of the patient's compensation?
No, in the trial court, in responding to the Chief Justice's questions, I got into the rational basis. The trial court accepted the arguments that were made in our briefs that are very similar to the arguments that we make in our brief before this court and that I made initially, and that is that the right to trial by jury is a constitutional right, and it can't be compromised by the legislature unless they do what they have to do to get a 5-6 verdict. They can't do it by a charade. They can't say, well, you're getting a jury verdict because, you see, the jury didn't know. We tricked the jury. We told them to deliberate without them knowing that the judge was going to do that. And that constitutionally, this is an assault on the independence of the judiciary that goes way beyond the question of medical malpractice. And thirdly, and I have, I've read the Richardson case and the Makos case, and I understand that the legislature has, under rulings of this court, a fairly broad basis for creating subclasses. But if this is not a suspect and irrational application of unequal protection, then why should Mrs. Guzman, if she were single, be able to get $350,000 And why should she now have to give some percentage of that to her husband and some percentage to each of her two children? And, you know, if she had 10 children, that would go on and on. There's talk these days about a marriage penalty, and they're talking about taxes. If this isn't a marriage penalty and a bearing children penalty, I don't know what is. It strikes me that although I don't think that the equal protection arguments are the strongest arguments in cases like this, I think in this case it has some real relevance. So it's on a constitutional basis we argue here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Warshefsky.
I snatched a minute back. Comes with age, Your Honor. I want to comment on the right to jury trial inviolate, which is really what we're talking about, that word, whatever it means. We violate jury verdicts every day. The question is what happens from verdict to judgment, and there you have the implication of common law and statutory law. A young woman gets hit out in front of University Bank. Loses her leg. Jury awards a substantial amount, 50% damages. Zero. The legislature had to go to 51%. Legislative changed. 51% on Ted's injured victim, and it's a zero. And is the jury engaged in a sham, or is it following the policies established by the legislature? And I don't think there's a constitutional difference between rights and remedies when we're talking about this. That's the legislative right to be involved in this area and make the policy judgments for the state of Wisconsin. Jury verdicts are violated. We put people in that verdict that can't even be held liable, like employers. We require that they be put in. And then we compare negligence. And then if someone can't pay, like GM, they get stuck for the whole thing. The jury verdict's violated all the time. And I just want to leave you with this. If there's somebody that ought to be mad, it ought to be the juries of this state. And they're mad both at the legislature and at the court, if that's the issue.
Well, don't tell them today.
Your Honor, Mr. Warshefsky has waved about the statistics from the brief of the Waddles, amicus brief, and talked about loss ratios and et cetera. These statistics are premiums from primary carriers. They are not the funds assessment statistics. That's a completely different matter. Look on or about page 6 of our brief. You will see the entire history of concern over continuing deficits. But the fact of the matter is, there is no constitutional requirement that there be a crisis before the legislature acts.
Does your brief tell you what the premiums are for the fund?
No. No, and I don't think I could tell you right now, Your Honor. You mean the assessments?
Yes.
I can't tell you, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. But there is no constitutional requirement that there be a crisis for the legislature to act. The legislature can act wherever it sees some social concern that requires addressing. Now, Mr. Warshefsky has talked about the classifications and the subclassifications.
Counsel, I repeat what we said in March, and I ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
Under the system that the legislature has devised, those that are most seriously injured, who have lost a huge quality of life, are expected by this system to bear the brunt and bear the responsibility for keeping the system solvent. That doesn't strike me as fair, fundamentally fair.
Your Honor?
Why, if the legislature, if I give you your point that the legislature can somehow impact on this, isn't there some kind of a constitutional responsibility to spread this pain? Why should those most seriously injured have to bear all of the brunt of responsibility?
Two answers to your question, Your Honor. First, those who bear the so-called brunt of this cap on economic damages bear the greatest benefits from the fund's guarantee of payment, a guarantee that is available to no other class of plaintiffs in Wisconsin. They benefit proportionately and, in fact, probably more than proportionately from it. Second, risk spreading is not a constitutional principle. It was a principle devised by Professor Keaton some decades ago, and it is now used as a justification for expanding causes of action, but it is nowhere enshrined in our Constitution. Nowhere does our Constitution say that juries have a right to make the law.
But it is enshrined to some degree anyway in equal protection and due process.
equal protection is equal protection. There must be a, fundamentally, there's got to be a reason for the division. There is a reason for the division, Your Honor. It applies to malpractice claims because this is a malpractice scheme. It sets a limit because the idea is to set a limit. The idea is to help the solvency of the fund. The idea is to assist the citizens of Wisconsin. These are legislative decisions. They may be unpleasant, but if there is a solution, it lies in the legislature, or failing that, in the ballot box. There are many more points to make. I would love to have more time to make them, but I'm running out of time, so I will close with this. Mr. Warshawski referred to our system of government. It is a marvelous system of government. The genius of our system of government, the genius, is that it allocates authority between three separate branches of government. But the vitality of our system depends upon each branch recognizing and respecting the domain of the others. I urge this court to recognize and respect that this is a legislative decision, not a judicial one, and to overturn the ruling of the trial court and uphold the constitutionality of this statute. I'm free to answer any further questions this court might have, but if you don't, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Apfel. Thank you, Mr. Skilton. Thank you, Mr. Warshawski.